From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we ask the Department of Environmental Quality what it's doing about the several recent revelations of contaminated water around the state.
Our top priority remains protecting people and the environment.
But there have been some hiccups. We talked to a Libertarian candidate for governor.
I've pledged to work with both Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Green Party members, and try to solve problems.
Then we'll talk with one of the investigative reporters who broke the Larry Nassar sex abuse story.
We often get questions, too, about the importance of reporting and about the justice that the survivors in the Larry Nassar case have received.
And a poet organizes an overnight event to give people space and time to grieve.
It's not that I got tired of talking about it, but I started to feel like people got tired of listening to me talk about it.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The slates of candidates vying for attention this year, of course, extend beyond Republican and Democrat. Today, we're going to meet another gubernatorial candidate, Bill Gelineau, who is seeking the Libertarian Party's nomination. Welcome.
Glad I could be here.
I understand you want to reduce spending and taxes in the state. With the concern about the deteriorating roads and other infrastructure, where do you plan to cut?
Well, one of the big areas of concern for me has been our prison system. You know, there's many people, even outside of politics, in academia, that look at the number of people we have housed in our prison system well in excess of our surrounding states. That would be one area where there's a lot of room to cut.
In what ways would you cut that? By more parole or simply cutting in costs? Because it seems that we tried that a couple of times with meal services.
Yeah, I had some discussion about that with someone the other day. Being a former restaurateur, I have some pretty strong feelings about how that was mismanaged. First and foremost, I would love to point some people to my website, which is cometogethermichigan.org, and you can learn a lot more about how this all kind of comes together. First and foremost, I've talked about the fact that I think the Michigan Strategic Fund, which is one of the key elements of discretionary money that's used in some of the areas that people might be most familiar with there are the advertisements we have for Pure Michigan.
Right. I want to get to the Michigan Strategic Fund. It's my next question, but I want to get this question about prisons. Where do you cut to make the cost savings in prisons you're talking about?
Sure. What I would do, and I've talked about the fact that we anticipate legalizing marijuana, number one. But if that doesn't happen, I intend to put together a board to pardon a vast number of people who have not committed a crime, a violent crime in conjunction with their drug offense. I believe that we have way too many people in prison and that we should work toward providing alternative sentencing and other mechanisms for just clearing the sheer numbers of people that we have in prison. I believe we have a prison culture in Michigan to the extent that we have about 30% more people in prison in Michigan than we do in Indiana or Ohio or Illinois. And that just doesn't comport with what I think makes sense. So that would allow us to shift a tremendous amount of resources to other needs.
Now, you mentioned the Michigan Strategic Fund. It's used to make grants and loans to business districts and directly to businesses. The state says it needs these kinds of incentives to compete with other states for business. Why do you think it should be eliminated?
Well, first and foremost, you're looking at a time now. We've got a very tight job market. And the notion that we need to attract more businesses when existing businesses are having a hard time finding staff, to me, doesn't fit with reality. And some of the states that don't do these things seem to get by just fine. One of the things as a libertarian we have real issues with is the subsidies that are used to provide monies to existing businesses and new businesses that are profitable. If businesses need to exist, they should go out into the marketplace and do the things they need to do. One of the words that you used in this, and the Michigan Strategic Fund has a lot of that, is grant money. And when we use the word grant money, we almost act as if the taxpayers don't fund that. And if you don't mind me telling you, one of the things that has bothered me the most is in my hometown. I live out in Lowell, and we have a showboat out there that has been on the river for 60 or 70 years, and it's in need of repair. And you know, our state senator was able to get a $1 million grant, and a lot of the local folks said, well, that's just fine because that's not like it's tax money. I think that's Chamber of Commerce material. I think those are the kinds of things that the state often puts money into that if local businesses, and I am a local businessman, we want to have things like that, those are the kinds of things you put fundraisers together for. I don't believe that's a responsibility of the state when we have so many other much more pressing concerns.
You've called for a 10% reduction in the Headley Amendment cap. Basically, that cap says you can't raise taxes more than a certain amount in the state, or it all has to be refunded to the taxpayers. Where is that now, and where do you want it to go?
Well, the cap has been set since 1978 at 9.45%.
9.45% of what?
Of personal income. So the Treasury cannot take in more money than 9.45% of personal income. So our Treasury Department calculates that, and twice in the last 40 years, there's actually been a small refund to each of the taxpayers. The current spending level is at about 8.05%, and I propose that we reduce it down 10% to 8.55, so it would actually be higher than our current spending level. Why that's important is to challenge particularly Republican members to say, if you're serious about maintaining a low spending level, then these are the things that I think we need to do constitutionally to help make sure that we set priorities.
You endorsed both of the marijuana legalization efforts that will be on the ballot. You call the prohibition of marijuana a budget wrecker. Explain that to us.
Well, again, I think the drug war itself, as more time has gone by, a greater number of people have come to see just how impactful that's been on our budget. It's tied up our courts. It requires an awful lot of police overtime. And probably my biggest concern is the degree to which it's ruined the lives of young people. You get marked with that, you know, red badge of drug offense, and it makes it difficult in terms of your trajectory, whether it be college or just your work life. And so I have endorsed both of them. I have issues with the MI Legalize program because of the price that I still think there's going to be an underground effort. There are going to be people growing on the side. Whereas I think the Abrogate proposal is cleaner and more consistent with my libertarian philosophy. It allows people to have that natural freedom and at the same time remove the black marks that have been put on people's careers with convictions from the time that we started scheduling.
You've indicated that if elected governor, you would do what you could to block the president of the United States from using Michigan National Guard troops in a foreign conflict. What's your concern?
I'm glad you brought that up. This is one thing, you know, I've mentioned that to be elected as governor, I know that I need to appeal to both Democrats and Republicans to broaden the base of people that might consider voting for a libertarian candidate. After 9/11, my personal responsibility involved managing a building company that I was working with, and I raised and lowered that flag so many times, every time that someone from Michigan was lost in these conflicts. And I just feel that constitutionally, as well as morally, it's the responsibility of our governor, who is the commander-in-chief of the Michigan National Guard, to be proactive in preventing that federalization to be done unless the Congress has declared war. You know, we have these actions that have now drug on for the better part of a generation, and it's terrible, the loss of life, the way in which so many people have been harmed, maimed, the PTSD, all of that. And I just think that our governor has been far too cooperative, whether it be a Democrat or a Republican, just allowing our National Guard troops to be used overseas without any check or balance. And so I've laid down a marker that I would do everything I can to thwart their efforts to use the Michigan National Guard in such a way. I feel it's a matter of principle. It's a matter of the Constitution. And it's a moral question, and I feel very good about trying to lay that marker down and challenge other candidates to do the same.
Part of the reason the federal government depends on the National Guard is difficulty in recruiting for our voluntary armed services. Wouldn't withholding National Guard troops ultimately result in bringing back the draft?
No, I don't think so. I think if the ideas that I'm talking about were utilized, what we might do is bring back some people from overseas bases. You know, we have troops in 165 countries, and ideally, if the mentality that I'm advocating were to take hold, we would need a much smaller force overall because we wouldn't have troops all over the planet. And it is one of those principles that when you think about libertarian philosophies, we want a more peaceful coexistence with our neighbors and not projecting American power around the world.
A Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate, Brian Ellison, recently proposed arming the homeless. You did not endorse that plan, but you did write on your campaign page an essay that justified such a controversial proposal. Why do you think that the arming the homeless proposal was necessary or at least justifiable?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to Michigan voters. And unfortunately, you know, Brian has not been given many opportunities, despite the fact that the Libertarian Party is for the first time a major party in Michigan, qualified for the primary. And in many ways, I think the frustration that can happen when a candidate feels like they're being completely ignored. Brian is the only active candidate that the Libertarian has for United States Senate. And So I don't agree with his proposal. I think there was a bit of what we call a macho flash there, putting himself out to a level of outrage to get attention. That's not my course, but I do understand it. I've been working in the party for about 25 years. I've been chairman of the party twice. And in doing so, sometimes feel the frustration of media that does not give thoughts and ideas an equal opportunity to be heard.
Being governor of Michigan is basically heading up a $56 billion a year corporation, which runs everything from health and welfare of our poorest systems to maintaining a highway system to regulating pollution, promoting business, and making sure that prisons are run correctly. What experience do you have that would qualify you to run the state?
Well, you know, I'm very good at surrounding myself with people who have skills. I've worked for a large national corporation, Fortune 500, had a lot of responsibilities, 100 and some people that reported to me, budgets of several million dollars. I'm not sure. I think most people would feel a bit of hubris to think that they can run something that's $56 billion. But you don't do that by yourself. You do it collaboratively. I think our current governor has learned some lessons, even with his vast large corporate experience, about the difficulty in having people work as a team and get the things done that need to be done. The reality is I would walk into that with a lot of effort to bring other people with good ideas to the table. And I've pledged to work with both Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Green Party members, and try to solve problems. That has really been the thing that I think I bring to my corporate life has been I'm a problem solver.
Bill Gelato is seeking the Libertarian Party's nomination for governor. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad I could be with you, Lester.
Up next, the reporter who broke the Nassar scandal explains how the story came together. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Few things in my 33 years of reporting have been more horrifying than the revelation of nearly two decades of Larry Nassar's sexual abuse of gymnasts, girls and women who were supposed to be getting medical treatment. That story came to life because of the investigative reporting by the Indianapolis Star newspaper. Marissa Kwiatkowski is one of the reporters who exposed the Nassar story, and she joins us now. You were already investigating USA Gymnastics. What was the concern about that organization?
So my colleagues Mark Alicia, Tim Evans, and I had been working on an investigation into how they handled sexual abuse allegations. And what we'd found was that they had a policy of dismissing allegations of sexual abuse as hearsay unless they were signed by a victim, a victim's parent, or an eyewitness to the abuse. And what that meant was that in some cases, the individual who had been accused would continue to move from gym to gym, abusing other gymnasts despite warning signs about their conduct.
An organization such as USA Gymnastics is a complex operation. You know, it's nationwide. How do you start breaking it down to determine what its policies and procedures were for handling sexual assault complaints?
So I had received a tip about USA Gymnastics being sued in a court in Georgia. And as part of that lawsuit, there had been depositions with high-ranking current and former USA Gymnastics officials. And it was through those depositions that we started to understand what that policy was. And from there, we really dug into records from all over the country to figure out exactly how that policy played out and the impact that it had on the safety of children.
So when you eventually confronted USA Gymnastics personnel, how difficult was it to get straight answers from them?
They declined to be interviewed in person. They, with one exception, would only speak with us through email. And when they would respond to our questions in writing, sometimes they would not answer certain questions or would give partial answers to other questions. So it became really difficult in the beginning to nail down exactly what was going on currently with the organization.
And how long did it take you to put that together before you actually published?
The day the first piece in the Out of Balance series published, which was August 4th of 2016, was the first day that we received an email from Rachel Denhollander that was alleging abuse at the hands of Larry Nassar.
So this is the first time his name has been mentioned, as far as you know.
We were aware of Larry Nassar. He was a high-profile doctor for gymnastics for many years, but that was the first time that we'd heard allegations of misconduct involving him.
It didn't take long before you heard more. Tell us about that.
Within a few weeks of Rachel's email, we received information from two other individuals about the alleged abuse that they also had suffered. And one was an Olympic medalist who at the time was a Jane Doe and has since come forward publicly. Her name is Jamie Dancher, and she's out of California. And then a third individual who was out of New York. And so we had three women from three different parts of the country who were at different levels of the sport of gymnastics who were really giving us almost identical accounts of what they had experienced.
When did it become clear how long and how many girls and women he had sexually abused?
I don't think that's even clear today. The last count that we'd had, it was more than 250 survivors of sexual abuse, but that number continues to change.
When did you know you had enough evidence to go ahead with the Nassar story?
There were two things that happened. The first was that Rachel Denhollander had reported to police and the situation was under investigation at Michigan State University. And the second was that a lawsuit had been filed by Jamie Dancher in California against Larry, USA Gymnastics, and other entities as well.
So you had court documents you could go through. Did you talk to the victims besides Denhollander?
We interviewed Jamie Dancher as well for the first piece in our series.
How did you feel about exposing this man and his crimes? How did you feel personally about that?
I don't know that I ever really thought about that, to be honest with you. I think we were so focused on making sure that we were right. I mean, you have to understand that at the time that we wrote our first piece about Larry Nassar, he was running for school board. He was a beloved member of the community. He was well known in gymnastics and in sports medicine, and he was still seeing patients at Michigan State University. He was the team doctor at Twist Stars Gymnastics Club. So it was really important to us to make sure that we were accurate and careful about how we were approaching that piece.
A lot of journalistic organizations have pointed to your stories as an example of why news is important. And I'm wondering, in these days of news media being labeled the enemy of the American people by the President of the United States, and being accused of fake news and so forth, what should people know about reporting as you did it with the Nassar case?
I don't think it's just how we do reporting, but how journalists all over the country do reporting, and that's we're meticulous and careful and focused not only on, you know, the ethics and the accuracy, but really making sure that we have a comprehensive understanding of what's going on. And that's not just happening with this investigation. It's with every piece that we do and every piece that our colleagues throughout the country are working on.
You're speaking at Grand Valley State University today. What's your address going to be about?
So it's a Q&A format, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I will just be answering whatever questions are asked of me.
You've probably have been asked a lot of questions already because this turned into a huge national story. What kind of questions do you usually get about covering the Nassar case?
A lot of what you and I have already talked about and you know, about the culture of gymnastics and how that was involved with it. And we often get questions, too, about the importance of reporting and about the justice that the survivors in the Larry Nassar case have received. I mean, there's been a lot of change both in the sport of gymnastics as well as the entire Olympic sports movement since our first piece on this topic published.
I'm wondering if you are going to pursue this, or are there other issues that you and your colleagues need to look into?
We are continuing to work on the USA Gymnastics investigation, but as I'm sure you know, there's always more to work on. So we're, you know, digging into that, but also digging into other things as well.
Marissa Kwiatkowski is an investigative journalist at the Indianapolis Star. She and her colleagues broke the story about Larry Nassar's sexual abuse of young gymnasts. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us, and thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Tomorrow night, beginning at 7 o'clock, the Detroit Institute of Arts will host a 14-hour overnight event called The Science of Grief. That idea came from Natasha T. Miller, a poet, and she joins us now. This project began from the loss of your brother. Would you tell us about what happened to him and about your own grief afterward?
Yeah, so my brother, who was, you know, you hear this from a lot of sister-brother relationships, was one of my best friends. You know, we grew up same mother, same father, same household. And on December 28th, 2013, he was in the city of Detroit, and he was gunned down. He was shot 15 times. And it was one of those unimaginable deaths because we were a year and 11 days apart. So to think about losing somebody, you know, that you're that close to is already kind of tragic. But the series of events was he was murdered a few days before New Year's. And then my birthday came around on January 3rd and he was cremated on my birthday. And then his funeral was the day after my birthday. And then his birthday was 11 days after that. So December and January were really hard months for me, but it was so much for me to process, you know, not just my brother being, you know, dead, but also the series of unfortunate events that came the following. It sent me into just like this depression and this grief that I couldn't overcome, and I had never experienced any grief like it. And for the last, you know, 4 years, I have basically acknowledged that grief, but also found ways to navigate that grief without access to, you know, things like therapy and counseling and other resources and other tools. But yeah, it was just one of those, you know, unimaginable things that you know, surprised us all.
How did this project, Science of Grief, evolve from that grief you experienced?
Well, honestly, one thing that I've noticed in the last 4 years of dealing with my brother's death is it's not that I got tired of talking about it, but I started to feel like people got tired of listening to me talk about it and tell the same stories. And one night I was, you know, in bed, and it was maybe around 3 a.m. and I closed my eyes and I started to feel sad about, you know, missing my brother. And I didn't want to get up and call anybody because, again, I felt like everybody is tired of hearing this story. We know, we get it. Your brother is gone and you're depressed over it. So I said, you know, to myself, what if other people feel like I feel right now? And what if they don't know that somebody else feels the way that they feel? And I said, well, what if you create this 24-hour event? Initially, it was a 24-hour event. What if you create this 24-hour event where people can come and speak about their grief and say, hey, I feel the same way you feel, or I feel similarly to how you feel. And we all feel this, you know, at different times of the day. You're not alone. And I looked at it and said, if the community did it together, this would be a community performance on grief. And then I said, let's talk about the science of grief, like what's behind the grief and how the grief actually, you know, affects us all physically, mentally, and emotionally.
So this is open to anyone who wants to share their personal stories of grief, but also to anyone who feels drawn to supporting others or feel the support of others. Why was it important to throw the doors open to the community?
Well, what I wanted to do was I wanted to make it, one, I'm from Detroit, and I feel like community is important. I feel like we need a space for everybody to acknowledge the grief that we've all been stricken with just by being, you know, Detroiters. And the second thing was I didn't want it to be an event where people felt like you were talking at them about their grief. I wanted to give everyday people the opportunity to say, this is how I feel. You know, I'm not a professional, or maybe I'm not a performer, I'm not an artist. You know, I am just a person dealing with grief, and I just want to tell my story. So I wanted to make sure that it was raw, in a sense of, again, like I feel like so many people tell us how to deal with our grief, but you don't get enough people asking simply like, how do you feel, or just listening to you. So it was really important that I get the whole community involved.
Well, you are an artist, and you will be performing. I understand you'll be performing a poem of yours. Can we hear some of it?
Yeah, so a summit of poem that I wrote about my brother, and it's called They Say, and a snippet of it is, they say you shouldn't mourn over the loss of a drug dealer. They say drug dealers stood on the tracks their whole lives, challenging a train, knew that even if the weather delayed it, death was still showing up at their front door. They say he died so casually. Say what's his name's child on Joy Road or Rosa Parks was murdered in cold blood on his front porch. They say his. They don't say his name. They don't sympathize with the death of a drug dealer unless he was their drug dealer, gave them free drugs, paid their rent once, kept their lights on, gave their kids a Christmas. They don't give drug dealers a backstory or a reason why he's just another one. They say he purchased the engraving. They say his casket was nice. They say his mother was nice, was burying her only son and still had enough strength to stand outside the church and laugh with his friends. They say his friends. They don't say his name. And that's just a snippet of a poem I wrote dedicated to how long it took me to actually say my brother's name out loud and in a poem.
What is your brother's name?
My brother's name is Marcus. And it has been really tough for me to say that. You know, I spent just, years saying my brother, my brother, my brother. And I forgot that this was not, you know, a role. This was not just a brother. This was a person. This was a human. This was, you know, there were so many things attached to his life. And I'm just now at the point again where I can actually say Marcus.
After several hours of hearing from people who want to tell their stories about grief, you turn to artists and performers to finish out the science of grief. How did you choose them?
Well, I broke grief down into 7 different categories. And in doing that, I thought about performers in the city that would just pair well with those categories and performers who had already been doing the work associated with the categories of grief I broke it down into. You know, example, I have Marsha Music, who is a native Detroiter who tells, you know, some of the most amazing and thorough stories about Detroit. I have her coming. And there's a section of Detroit grief where she'll speak to, you know, the city and the grief that it's been stricken with. And I have Aya, which is a trans harpist coming, and we have, like, we're speaking about trans grief and kind of, you know, playing before that. So it was just me, you know, being an artist, knowing artists and saying, like, you know, one, we included artists because we just didn't want this to be people just being hit heavy with just these conversations about grief, but we wanted grief to be translated in a different way. And then that led me to just picking people who I knew could translate it, you know, in an uplifting way, and again, in a thorough way, and people who were just already, you know, doing the work associated with the category.
Now, this is a 14-hour event. Are you expecting your audience to sit through the entire evening?
Absolutely not. I think the only person that's going to sit through 14 hours is me. And even last night, I said to myself, how exactly are you going to do this? So how I envision it is, you know, it's a free event. So I want people to feel free to come and go as they please. You know, it's a heavy conversation. So I want people to come and say, hey, I'm going to sit in for an hour or two, and then I'm going to go upstairs and maybe talk to some of the resources that we have on staff. Or I'll stay from 10 to 12 and I'll come back from 7 to 9. I do want it to be a rotating audience. I want as many people in and out of the DIA as possible. But I can assure you that no one is going to stay for 14 hours unless they work there.
So what do you want from the project? What are you expecting?
Well, honestly, to just give people tangible resources where they can connect with organizations, people, things outside of, you know, their normal circle to help them deal with their grief moving forward. I want people to just be in community. And I think that people have their own expectations for what the event is. You know, some people just want to come and tell their story. Some people just want to come and listen. You know, eventually I hope that, you know, we can look back on this day and this event can happen annually, and we can look back on this day and in Detroit, you know, this can be our national day of grieving and accepting and acknowledging our grief. But I want people to get out of it, you know, what they want to get out of it. And maybe that's just, you know, again, it's just to listen. It's just to talk. It's just to tell my story. That's what I want to do, at least.
Natasha T. Miller organized an event called The Science of Grief. It begins tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Thank you. How do you know if nursing homes and assisted living communities are treating you or your loved ones properly? And what do you do if they're not? We'll have that conversation on Stateside soon, but first, we need your questions. What do you want to know about how the elderly are treated in Michigan? How about the system set up to care for people who are aging? Do you have any questions about what your rights are? Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Again, that number, 734-764-7840. Or go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and leave your question there. You might hear it on Stateside next week. Still to come, a DEQ official responds to reports of delayed action with polluter Wolverine worldwide.
We are committed to rooting out the sources of PFAS in the state's waters, and our top priority remains protecting people and the environment.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. According to a state website, Michigan has 28 sites in 15 communities with known PFAS contaminated levels in the water. PFAS is an acronym for a group of widely used industrial chemicals known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. The department has been accused of being too slow in cleanup and too cozy with polluters. Joining me to talk about that is Kathleen Shirey. She's the acting director of the Remediation and Redevelopment Division at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you characterize this contamination problem we're seeing at many spots across the state?
Well, first, I'd like to say thanks for having me on. I'm very glad to talk about the work we're doing. I would characterize this as a growing and global concern. We are discovering a great deal about this family of compounds that are fairly common in our environment pretty much every day. It's something that we're committed to finding the sources of PFAS in the state's waters. Our top priority is always to protect the people and the environment. So we are doing as much as we can to learn everything about it. It is, as you say, in a number of sites across a number of communities in the state.
Yeah, a lot of this is called legacy pollution because it's been around for a while and sometimes before there were any regulations on anything. Let's start, though, with the various military installations that have groundwater contamination, largely because of firefighting foam that contains PFAS, and that was used for decades. There's an old Air Force base in Oscoda, the National Guard base in Grayling, the Alpena Combat Readiness Center. There's also another closed Air Force base in Marquette County and the UP. Who's coordinating cleanup at these military sites, and do all of them have the same kind of problem?
Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is doing some of the coordination. Some of those sites are directly under the Air Force's purview, and DEQ is working with all of them.
And when their contamination gets off base, as it can do, as it travels as a plume underground, then is that solely your issue, or are you still working with them?
We are still working with them. In some cases, the state, the DEQ, is spending our dollars to do some plume chasing. In some cases, some of the other agencies are doing it.
Michigan radio reporter Bryce Huffman was up in Oscoda speaking with the residents earlier this year. A number of residents he spoke with talked about the DEQ's slow response. Here's local resident Ross Tingley.
Right out of the first meeting, I asked him, I said, is the only reason that you guys are even here and bringing us up is because of Flint?
The state began testing groundwater in Oscoda back in 2010, so why has it taken so long to get corrective action?
In large part because PFAS is an emerging concern. We are one of the first states in the nation that are regulating PFAS at all, and we have just plain learned a whole lot more about it as we've gone in and tested. The Air Force has been really at the forefront of testing things on their bases, and we've been working with them to go off base to determine how far this stuff travels and what it's doing in our environment. We're working to protect the people and the environment as we move forward.
Are you satisfied with what the Air Force is doing at this point?
Well, I think you probably know that we are in a dispute resolution process with the Air Force, so I can't say I'm entirely satisfied, but most certainly they're working with us to the extent that they're able to.
If concerned residents who live near one of these bases want to find out what's happening, who should they call? You? Someone in the Department of Defense? Where do they go?
Well, first, you can go to the MPART page, which is the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, which is the structure that the governor has set up to manage PFAS response across the state. That website is michigan.gov/PFAS response. That will give you links to some of the larger sites, including the Escoda Wordsmith one, as I recall. And there will be contact information on that.
And when we say PFAS, it's the letter PFAS, just to be
That's
clear.
Right. That's right.
Let's shift to Wolverine Worldwide's House Street dump site in Plainfield Township and near Grand Rapids. This is where the shoe company dumped waste from 3M Scotch Guard that contains PFAS, and that was used to waterproof Hush Puppy shoes. How confident are you that you know where all the groundwater contamination is with this Wolverine situation?
We're still working to discover where it is exactly. We have done an amazing job of getting 1,500 homes sampled in the area and gotten 600 whole house filters in because we are working first and foremost to protect people and the environment. We will continue to work on investigating how the contamination moves in the environment and the aquifers as we move forward here.
Are you doing any drilling or testing outside of the wells to determine how far this plume is spread?
You mean outside of the residential wells?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we are. Wolverine is actively putting in some monitoring wells. We are putting in some, Waste Management Inc. is putting some in at the state disposal site that is in the area. And DEQ is also going to be doing some additional work.
How much are you relying on the work that's being done by consultants hired by Wolverine?
In Michigan, the way that the pollution law works, we hold those who are responsible for that pollution to account. So they are responsible for gathering that information. Now we are also providing very close oversight. We will continue to do that. We've asked for extensive data validation. We're confident in the data that we're using to make decisions.
So Wolverine's doing the testing and you're verifying?
That's correct.
Earlier this month, MLive's Garrett Ellison reported that a state geologist told superiors at the DEQ in April 2017 that drinking water for homes southeast of the House Street dump site were likely contaminated. The DEQ emails MLive obtained showed that many of the homes the geologist identified weren't tested until 5 months later. Meanwhile, there's a two-year-old who lives in that area. He's got blood levels of PFAS at 484,000 parts per trillion. This two-year-old's parents told MLive they first learned about this from attorneys. So why did the DEQ allow months of delays when you've got vulnerable children and others drinking contaminated water that could be linked to certain cancers, thyroid disorders, and other problems?
Well, you know, I have two children of my own, and certainly we're all concerned about what it is that our children are drinking and keeping our homes safe. We're, the DEQ, committed to rooting out the sources of PFAS in the state's waters, and we're trying to hold those, we will be holding those responsible for that pollution to account. In terms of the time frame, environmental investigations of necessity work on one piece of information or a number of pieces of information coming in and us being able to look at those to determine the next pieces. The geology in the area is certainly an important piece in knowing how to move forward, but at that point in time, we had already begun some sampling. that we needed to look at the results in order to determine where to go next. And what we did do next was not only the list of wells that our geologist had provided, but even more homes that we felt needed to be sampled.
But why didn't you notify people when you even had a hint there was a problem?
We notified anyone that we were able to go out and test and say we felt there was a problem.
But it took 5 months to get to this. In fact, you did not get to this family's house with the little boy, apparently, because the DEQ didn't notify him. An attorney did. So what's happening here? What ball was dropped?
We're holding those who are accountable or who are responsible for that pollution accountable. We are for an environmental investigation moving at lightning speed. I look at what's happened in a year's time, and it is astounding. We are committed to rooting out the sources of PFAS in the state's waters, and our top priority remains protecting people and the environment.
But why wasn't a precautionary note sent to the people in that area when you felt there was a problem? People should have been notified, right?
We didn't have information at that point to say that there was a problem. We had information to say that we needed to look at the potential for a problem. And as we looked at the areas that were necessary, we certainly notified each and every homeowner that we could contact. We also began working on larger public notifications towards the end of the summer.
MLive also reported that it looks like it's a pretty cozy relationship with Wolverine. Did the DEQ let Wolverine representatives draft talking points for the agency on communicating to the public? Is this normal when it comes to working with companies that you regulate?
We work very closely with Wolverine in that we oversee all of their work. You have to consider that that was a somewhat unique situation in that we were dealing with what at that time was an unregulated contaminant. We had to get that information from Wolverine in order to protect public health and the environment.
So this is not something that was on the toxic registry. You didn't have a lot of experience with it. You were relying on the company to tell you about the chemistry and the potential harm?
No, we weren't relying on the company to tell us about the chemistry. We were relying on them to tell us what their uses were. And we were also using our resources to go out and do the field work.
Still drafting talking points for the agency, is that normal?
No, that's not our usual practice. This was a unique situation where we really needed to get out there quickly. We wanted to be responsive to the concerned citizens and anyone else that was in the area. And this was a very unusual situation. We, again, trying to hold those responsible for pollution to account, we went to them and gathered the information we needed.
MLive's Ellison also reported that a DEQ official admitted to sharing his, Ellison's, Freedom of Information Act request with Wolverine, an attorney, a day before releasing the information. That's not really the way it's supposed to be done, is it?
We are always committed to getting our FOIA responses out, and we do sometimes share a courtesy copy with another party.
With the potential polluter?
Sometimes. When they are, in fact, working in the area actively, yeah, it can happen.
Why would you do that?
It's in part to hold them responsible. That helps to hold their feet to the fire sometimes. When they know that there are other parties out there interested, in addition to the potential enforcement work that the state might undertake.
When you've got a pollution situation like this, what is DEQ's priority? Is it working with the corporation that might be responsible for the pollution or the citizens who are drinking contaminated water?
Our top priority is always protecting people and the environment. We are completely committed to finding the sources of PFAS in the state's water and to holding those who are responsible for that pollution to account.
In this case, though, the emails that Ellison recovered show that you were trying to keep the company's name out of it in email exchanges and so forth. There was some cooperation between the agency and the company to kind of keep it quiet for a while. Why?
I wouldn't call it cooperation. We generally try and do our work as efficiently and as effectively as we possibly can.
When you look at the recent history of the DEQ, watching major corporations exceed pollution limits as revealed by Environment Michigan and reported on by Bridge Magazine, or the Flint water crisis, or the handling of this Wolverine issue, how would you describe the public's confidence in DEQ?
I think the public should be very confident that DEQ's priority is always to protect people and the environment. We're committed to looking for sources of contamination and making sure that people are not affected by those adversely. It's our policy and our statutory responsibility to hold people accountable for pollution to account, or responsible for pollution to account, and we will continue to do those things. I think people can be utterly confident in that.
This contamination near Rockford, the contaminated water near those closed Air Force bases and the dioxin plume in Ann Arbor, makes you wonder if there are other legacy contamination issues the DEQ should be investigating but doesn't have the money or personnel to investigate. Are there other spots that we should be concerned about in the state?
Well, we have many, many areas that we are looking at legacy contamination. We have a proud history in the state of industry, and that does leave some legacy contamination. As we learn about places that might need further investigation or remediation, we go after them as quickly as possible. For example, well, by the end of next week, we will have met with 200 wastewater treatment plant people across the state to identify their users and try and eliminate PFAS from being discharged into any of our water resources.
With all these different issues popping up just recently, does the agency have enough funding to get the job done the way it should be done?
We're working with the legislature and the governor's office to obtain sufficient funding to continue to go. Certainly, we've made it known that we've kind of run out of the CMI funding. We're running on a little bit of fumes there, but we have
Can you explain CMI? Because I don't know.
Clean Michigan Initiative funding. Those were the large bond issues that were in the 1980s and 90s. And those did fund environmental cleanup for the state for a number of years. We still have a little bit of that money left for groundwater cleanup, environmental cleanup, but it's not much. And we have been working very hard with the legislature. Now, in terms of PFAS, the legislature has given us $23 million to increase our staffing, that we will be doing some of the testing across those many communities that you mentioned. We're funding our in-state laboratory so that they can begin to do PFAS testing, which is a very specialized thing. Only about a dozen laboratories across the country do it at this point. And we're doing things like testing public water supplies and those wastewater treatment plants and looking at our surface waters and continuing to work on the groundwater cleanup sites that we have. So the $23 million will be well spent on that.
Is it enough money, though, the $23 million? I mean, that's the real question here. Is the legislature going to be willing, is the governor going to sign off enough money for you to get all of this work done in a timely manner?
Well, in some respects, you'd have to ask them that. But they've certainly expressed a lot of willingness to us to make sure they find us funding.
That is Kathleen Shirey. She's the acting director of the Remediation and Redevelopment Division at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Thanks very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you so much.
If you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Today, Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening.